the Republicans to wake up is... What the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Great listeners do support this program, and I'm grateful to Kathleen Lowy, Eugene Kenny, Cameron Troxell, and Kathleen Emmer. They voluntarily subscribe to this program. You can do it, too, if you're able financially. Just click on peterbcollins.com, and on the right-hand side of the homepage, our subscriptions are there. Voluntary subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. I'm fresh back from a week in the frigid Midwest. And I just finished listening to Hosni Mubarak's speech from Egypt via Al Jazeera English. And we were expecting change. That's the name of this song from Tears for Fears. But President Mubarak is confronting the demonstrators and saying that he will liberalize the Constitution and move for change in Egypt after stability is restored. Coming up in this podcast in a few minutes, my conversation with Professor Juan Cole at the University of Michigan, recorded just 2 days ago on the 8th of February. And he offers important context and some historical background to the uprising in Egypt, and I think you'll find it quite informative and very useful. Also later in the podcast, Daryl Perry returns to our program, a co-founder of the Boston Tea Party. And while I don't agree with Tea Party people on too many things, the Boston Tea Party is different from Sarah Palin's version of the Tea Party, and they are libertarian, somewhat originalists. And Daryl Perry and I do agree that the Patriot Act should not be renewed. So we're going to talk about that and the creeping police state here in the United States. But first, to the police state in Egypt. And before we give you the conversation with Professor Juan Cole, just a quick summary of the Hosni Mubarak speech to his nation on the 10th of February. And it was very interesting to see it on Al Jazeera because they split the screen between the official Egyptian state television and the coverage of the crowd in Liberation Square, Tahrir Square in Arabic. And the crowd was listening, hoping to hear Mubarak say that he will in fact step down. And when they didn't hear that, they became restless, started chanting. And then the crowd started roaring later on in Mubarak's speech when it became clear that he's not stepping down. And using the symbol that many of us remember from the reporter who threw his shoes at George W. Bush in Iraq a few years ago, the crowd showed their shoes to Mubarak while chanting in Arabic, "He must leave, he must leave." What did he say? Well, he was all over the map, and to be fair, the translation was not real precise. And I give the translator credit for trying to keep up. It's difficult to do live translation. But what he said was that he saluted the protests, he saluted the young people, and he made it sound like he was listening to the Egyptian population. And then he offered a bunch of half steps, and as one of the Al Jazeera commentators mentioned, he did this in a very condescending, paternalistic way. And I believe that it's much more that chemistry, that attitude, that will cause and spark further rebellion by the people of Egypt than the actual words that he spoke. He said that we need dialogue to exit the crisis, that it will lead to a clear roadmap and a timetable, that he supports constitutional amendments, and he has appointed committees, two committees, that are transparent and professional, and that they will be reporting back to him. He got the first report, he said, and he has embraced the proposal to amend six elements in the Constitution, and one of those relates to term limits. Now, here's a guy who has served for 30 years without term limits, and he's saying that he'll amend the Constitution to make sure that nobody could be a dictator without term limits again in the future. That's pretty interesting. Hard to imagine that people find that credible or sincere. And then he talked about Section 179 of the Egyptian Constitution. This is what has permitted the extraordinary near police state climate that has been active there virtually since Mubarak took over 29 years ago. And he's saying that he will lift that, but only after stability returns. And so imagine a teacher addressing an elementary school class and saying, well, you can have recess when you start to behave. And so while he honors the victims of the thugs that he unleashed in Tahrir Square last week, and he's calling for speedy investigations and harsh punishment for those responsible, he's not stepping down. Now, in a line of the speech late in his speech that was imprecisely translated, he suggested that he's going to transfer some of his power to his handpicked vice president, Omar Suleiman. And you're going to hear about Suleiman in the words of Professor Juan Cole here in just a few minutes. Suffice it to say that he is a torturer. He is the favored torturer of the United States. We sent a lot of people to be roughed up and brutally treated in Egypt, hoping to extract information from them during the Bush-Cheney era. And he was the guy at the front of that. He is Israel's choice to succeed Mubarak. And while the Obama administration is all over the map in their comments, it's pretty clear to me that the U.S. wants the stability over freedom. They want stability over the unpredictability of allowing the revolution to take its course. And so we will be falling in line, it appears, behind this idea of transferring some power to Omar Suleiman, the new vice president. But I don't think this is going to stick. It really seems improbable. And several times during the speech, Mubarak went out of his way to say that he doesn't take orders. We will not allow others to gloat over us. We shape our own decisions. Where else here? He said that he doesn't allow anyone to dictate to him from the outside. So he's trying to suggest, oh, no foreign pressure, he said, has been involved in this. And he said a lot of things that, frankly, are bullshit. He said he never sought false power. He feels pain in his heart for those who have suffered. Now, his ability to feel pain, of course, was absent for 29 years as he ruthlessly suppressed any political opposition, tortured many of those people. And so his words will fall like lead balloons on the active population there in Egypt. So what had been the prospect of an end to the first phase of the uprising in Egypt with an announcement of some sort from Mubarak that he would step down soon or set a date to step down, he's saying that he will stay through September and that while he is allowing amendments to the Constitution and he will scrap the authoritarian rule under Section 179 when things settle down, it's very clear that he is trying to negotiate with people who have issued non-negotiable demands. And so this story will continue, and we will certainly keep covering it. One other note before we go to the Juan Cole interview, I tried to reach my two contacts who are on the ground in Cairo, both members of Code Pink, Ty Barry and Medea Benjamin. And it could be that the circuits are busy because so many people are calling. It could be the circuits are jammed because the government doesn't want us to get through. I don't know which it is, but that is what I know. One final note that my news sources today indicate that multiple platoons of U.S. Marines have been activated and are on call, ready to be shipped to Egypt at any moment. The purported reason to protect American citizens there, well, I'll leave it at that. And we will see if they are deployed, and if so, for what purpose. So coming up next, Professor Juan Cole on Egypt, and a little bit later in this podcast, Daryl Perry of the Boston Tea Party on the efforts in Washington to extend the police state architecture of the Patriot Act.
And the Peter B. Collins Show is on the road in Michigan today. I want to dedicate today's program to my mother-in-law, Rose Shatter. It is her 85th birthday today, here on the 8th of February. And we took advantage of this opportunity to meet in person with the University of Michigan's Professor Juan Cole. We've talked many times by telephone. He's helped me with my Muslim pronunciations. You taught me how to say butter brigade. It's great to see you in person, Professor.
Likewise, Peter.
First, I want to direct people to your blog, juancole.com. I've spent some time there recently, and you've been focused pretty extensively on Egypt, and of course, we'll get to Israel in a moment. Before we started the recording here, I got a little background on you, and you spent some time in Cairo as a graduate. That's where you got your master's degree, is that right?
That's correct. I did a master's degree at the American University in Cairo. I also went back with Fulbright and Social Science Research Council grants to do further research in Egypt. Altogether, I probably lived there about 3 years, and I was there last May.
So fascinating to see what's going on in Egypt, also a little frightening because it's hard to see exactly how this will all play out. Let me start by asking, at this point, can you identify proximate causes of this remarkable people power revolution?
One of the causes that's not being spoken about so much is the economic downturn of the 2008-2009 period, when speculative investments by Western banks and, quite frankly, widespread fraud undermined the financial system of the world and threw the United States and Europe into a deep recession, almost a depression. Well, the Middle East is very tightly connected to those regions. The United States and Europe are big markets for Middle Eastern agricultural and manufactured goods. There are a lot of Middle Eastern laborers in Europe in particular who send back remittances to home, and if they're unemployed, they can't send back remittances. And then the economic downturn also caused a deep fall in the price of petroleum. In Egypt, the labor force is probably about 23 million out of 81 million, and about 3 million are guest workers, mainly in oil countries. So when the price of petroleum falls deeply, and it fell from a height of $140 a barrel in 2008 to, at one point in 2009, it was, I think, in the 30s. So that means workers get laid off or are paid less, have less work, and so again, the remittances and the kind of safety valve that the oil countries represented for Egyptian labor was blunted, it was taken away to some extent. So although Egyptian banks were not exposed to those speculative investments and the finance sector in Egypt did all right, the subsidiary effects of the crisis on Europe and the United States were such as to have a big impact on Egypt. Now, Egypt is an industrializing country. 25% of its economy is now manufacturing. And a downturn of that size means that its manufactured goods can't move. It does make autos and auto parts. That's not a good business to be in recent years. So the textile workers in in Al-Mahalla al-Kubra, near Cairo, struck in 2008 and got up a labor movement, which was also supported by white-collar youth activists. It was kind of like back in the late 60s, early 70s in the United States, you had an alliance of the New Left on campuses with textile workers in North Carolina and so forth to some extent. Well, it's that kind of configuration in Egypt. Well, the government intervened to break up that strike. It was held on April 6, 2008. But the April 6th committee that was formed jointly of white-collar office workers, often unionized, and blue-collar workers, and college youth, continued to exist underground. And they were the ones that called for the January 25th demonstration in Tahrir Square in downtown Cairo. So to some important extent, this is a labor movement, and it hasn't been reported that way in the U.S. press, just as the U.S. press in general doesn't report on labor movements.
So what about Al Jazeera and the overthrow of the regime in Tunisia? Was that something that was seen as a signal, or are we connecting these things in the West in ways that are not necessarily connected in the region?
Well, Tunisia had some of the same roots that I've been talking about in the recent economic crisis, which also hurt their economy. Tunisia had some special conditions in the sense that had very high unemployment among college graduates, something like 22%. So as a historian, I can say, generally speaking, if you're a ruler, you never want a lot of angry, educated people in your country, because they're educated and they know how to cause trouble. That was a particular problem in Tunisia. The economic situation did worsen because of the crisis for working class people and rural people as well, and there is relatively high unemployment, something like 13% in the last few years. And then in Tunisia, it had this very odd political economy where the ruling family was like vampires. They were just, they took over everything, and they sucked the blood out of the economy. The U.S. cable traffic released by WikiLeaks suggests that in 2008, 50% of the economic elite of Tunisia was related either to the president, Zinedine Ben Ali, or to his wife, Leila Trabelsi. This was a mafia state. And people in Tunisia, if you had a small business, you were always afraid the Trabelsis would show up and say, this is a nice business, it would be too bad if something happened to it. Maybe actually I own it. That kind of thing occurred. They owned all the media, then they wouldn't let you criticize them in the media. So the combination of the very narrow sliver of the economic elite at the top, the way in which they'd battened on this economy, then the downturn, the way it made a lot of people more desperate than they had been, and the high unemployment among college graduates, all came together into this mass protest, which was pioneered really in rural towns and moved towards the capital. The rural towns were not as under control of the secret police, because it's a police state, as the capital. And what people found is that if they came out in sufficient numbers, the secret police just couldn't do anything about it. And sure, they helped to inspire the Egyptian masses to come out as well, but Egypt had already had this movement of April 6, 2008, and there were already substantial numbers of dissidents. And so they just needed to convince a lot of people in the public that if they did this thing, if they came out to demonstrate, that they wouldn't all be killed. And what Tunisia did was to make it clear that, well, if enough come out, then you can't take the whole population out and shoot them.
Now, the economic numbers you cited about Tunisia are fascinating. How does that compare to Egypt? Because we've just seen recent reports that Mubarak has racked up somewhere around $70 billion in personal wealth. Some of that came from you and me.
Sure. Well, Egypt is so different from Tunisia because it's such a bigger place. Tunisia's population is a little over 10 million. Egypt's population, 81 million. And so inevitably, you couldn't have that situation in Egypt that you had in Tunisia where, like, the ruling family owns most things. And the Mubareks are very wealthy. But still, there are other billionaires. There are other forces in Egyptian society. They can't dominate in the same way that Ben Ali did and his wife in Tunisia. But some of the same structural problems are there. These were states with a large public sector. They would, in American parlance, they would be called socialist back in the 60s and 70s, which then liberalized. They sold some of the state-owned enterprises and tried to move to a more neoliberal model. But they didn't go completely in that direction. So there's still a big public sector, often bloated and inefficient, but the private sector is bloated and inefficient too. And a lot of decisions are made by the government, by the central government. And when the government makes central decisions about the economy, there's always a possibility of essentially insider trading. If you're in the government and you know a decision that's going to be made, then you can buy up stock or you can invest and so forth. So there's, in Egypt, there was a much bigger economic elite and a much more diverse one than in Tunisia, but it had some of the same mafia-like characteristics and a lot of insider trading. And so there were a lot of people who, you know, were not well-connected. They might be well-educated, or they might have a little bit of capital, who were disadvantaged very much in this system. And they are the ones who are demonstrating alongside the workers who are very poorly paid and have poor working conditions. And, you know, when you have an authoritarian state, you're not obliged to bargain with unions. You just tell them.
Professor Juan Cole with us here at the University of Michigan. And, Professor, I've been listening to right-wing talk radio and watching a little Fox News the last few days just to get a flavor of what their talking points are. And they're hammering the Obama administration, suggesting, or at least inferring, that they'd like to see us invade Egypt and prop up the Mubarak government. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts. The other talking point that they promote is that the Muslim Brotherhood is a dangerous faction that will control Egypt in a post-revolutionary period. I find that pretty hard to accept, but I'd like to get your views.
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood is an old, long-standing fundamentalist party in Egypt, which was founded in 1928. And the purpose of the party is Muslim revivalism. They reacted against the long years of British rule in Egypt and the imposition on Egypt of British norms of administration, British law, and so forth. So, however, they're not the majority of Egyptians. In free and fair elections, my guess is they might get 33% of the seats. But not a majority. They don't have support in the officer corps, which has been purged of people who look like they might pray. So I can't imagine a scenario where there's a junior officer coup that brings the Muslim Brotherhood to power. So I don't actually understand the scenario whereby they take over. It's certainly they are not behind these protests. It's the factory workers, the white collar workers. It was planned out to some extent by Wael Ghanem, who's a Google executive. It's that kind of person. And if you look at him, you listen to him, he's not a Muslim fundamentalist by any stretch of the imagination. So I think there's a large area of not so much secular but civil politics. That is to say, if you say secular implies people are atheists or agnostics, well, that's not exactly the case. Of course, it's not the case in much of the United States either. But there's civil politics, which is not about, you know, imposing a fundamentalist version of religion. There's more civil politics in Egypt than these outside observers are understanding. Will the Muslim Brotherhood be more influential than it is now in a democratic setup? Absolutely. Would it be hegemonic? I don't see it. And it seems to me there's also some evidence of a big generational divide. You see the Muslim Brotherhood guys, they're in their 50s and 60s, they have a little white in their beard. And you see the young people demonstrating at Tahrir Square. They're obviously like 20 and 22, and they don't have beards. Now, that's one of the ways that the Muslim fundamentalists distinguish themselves. So I'm wondering whether they're even very popular among the youth who are making this revolution. The scenario whereby the Muslim Brotherhood takes over Egypt, you know, you can't say it's impossible. You can't rule it out altogether. And this is one of the reasons I would never be very good in these inside the Beltway debates, because I'm a fair person and I'm a scholar. I'm trying to do analysis. So I would give them the point that, you know, that is a potential outcome. But you have to give these potential outcomes percentage chances. And the percentage chance of the Muslim Brotherhood taking over Egypt anytime soon, in my view, is low.
Sean Hannity tries to draw a connection between al-Zawahiri, who was the number two in al-Qaeda, and basically try to paint the Muslim Brotherhood as all fully radicalized jihadists. And on the one hand, I can understand that many Muslim Brotherhood members have been radicalized because they've been subjected to long imprisonment with torture and a denial of basic human rights by the Mubarak regime and probably Sadat before that. So to what extent do you think that there is a radicalized faction that Americans should have any concern about?
There are Muslim radicals in Egypt, although most of them have been chased out of the country, killed, or imprisoned. The Muslim Brotherhood is not among them. The Muslim Brotherhood made a deal with Anwar al-Sadat in the 1970s. Sadat had been vice president under the great leader Gamal Abdel Nasser, who helped to make the 1952 military coup, and this government we have now is a continuation of that. And Abdel Nasser was a secularist and increasingly, you know, allied with the Soviet Union and pursued socialist policies. Sadat didn't approve. He was a man of the right. He liked entrepreneurs, and he also thought that the Soviet Union was overbearing and weak, that the real action was with the United States. So Sadat wanted to turn Egypt around and make an alliance with the United States, open up the economy to entrepreneurship. And he was opposed by all those lingering socialists in the government that had been put there by Abdel Nasser. So Sadat needed an ally in civil society. And he reached out to the Muslim Brotherhood because they were on the right wing. They have a very deep belief in private property. If only Sean Hannity could hear me say this, he might change his mind. So the Muslim Brotherhood actually objected to Abdel Nasser's land reforms, which John F. Kennedy encouraged him to do. In any case, the Muslim Brotherhood made a deal with Sadat back in the 70s that they would be brought into the mainstream of Egyptian society. They wouldn't be imprisoned or tortured or executed in the way that they had been earlier when they were radical, if they would behave themselves, if they wouldn't try to overthrow the government, if they wouldn't engage in terrorism and so forth. They accepted that deal. So the problems that Egypt has had with Muslim fundamentalism, including Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is from an organization called the Egyptian Islamic Jihad. To my knowledge, Zawahiri was never a member of the Muslim Brotherhood.
He's often linked to them in American coverage.
Yes, I can't entirely understand that. I don't see any evidence of... He was from a distinct section of the Muslim activist movement, which was much more radical. And there was a figure, Sayyid Qutb, who had been a member of the Muslim Brotherhood and who probably helped to inspire Zawahiri as a young man. But Sayyid Qutb went so far in his ideas that the Brotherhood disowned him. And the leadership wrote refutations of his works. One of the things that Sayyid Qutb said was that it's all right to throw Muslims out of Islam. So Abdel Nasser was not really a Muslim, and Sadat was not really a Muslim, and so forth. And the Muslim Brotherhood doesn't accept that principle. And Sunni Islam in general frowns on that kind of thoroughgoing excommunication. The Sunni Islam is a big tent. So the Brotherhood didn't accept the Sayyid Qutb wing, and threw them out. And Zawahiri, to my knowledge, you know, became a radical when he was 16 or so and joined this Islamic Jihad group. I don't know that he ever had any direct connection with the Brotherhood at all. And certainly, he and they are rivals, and they denounce him, and he denounces them. You know, the Republicans are always complaining that the left blames them for the white supremacists, and the people on the far right in the United States are often, you know, somehow their attempts are made to attach them to elements of the Republican Party, and they're doing the same thing when they attach Zawahiri to the Muslim Brotherhood.
We're talking with Professor Juan Cole here on the Peter B. Collins Show. What is your sense of the way the Obama administration has handled this this evolving challenge?
The Obama administration has been caught flat-footed and has responded all over the map. It's been an evolving challenge to which they've had an evolving response. Their initial response by Hillary Clinton was that the regime is stable.
And Biden said that he's not a dictator. Mubarak is not a dictator.
And Joe Biden said that he's not a dictator. And both were efforts to shore Mubarak up. The U.S. is very invested in his rule. But it's shameful. Now, President Obama himself was better when he started speaking the weekend after the revolts broke out. And more measured. But then he sent this Frank Wisner out who had long and deep ties to the Egyptian regime, who appears to have been a lobbyist for it, and then who came out last weekend and said that it's important that Mubarak stay for the stability of Egypt, which the Obama administration then immediately backed off. But why send somebody like that out? It's of a piece with the Obama administration in general, which is that I don't know whether it's because he was young and inexperienced and not from the power centers of American politics, but Obama has this fascination with the old hand. So you have an economic crisis, you bring in the old Wall Street hands. You have an Egypt crisis, you bring in the old Egypt hands. And it's a lack of independent judgment on his part. He shouldn't have been sending somebody out who's in Mubarak's back pocket, like Wisner. And this tendency is reinforced by the people around Obama, like Hillary, who's a very establishment figure. This week now, they're starting to talk about, well, things are returning to normal, and there'll be a transition, and we don't know what it'll look like, and it's all right. It should be remembered, Tunisia took 34 days from the time the outbreak of the initial demonstrations until Zinedine Ben Ali got on a helicopter and fled. We're halfway through that period at the moment. So for the Obama administration to say, now it's over with, seems to me really inadvisable. And even if they're saying it for atmospherics, when it obviously doesn't fit reality, it doesn't help the atmospherics.
So is the Obama administration, in your view, prepared to embrace Omar Suleiman, who was hastily appointed vice president? He wasn't even identified to the Egyptian people until about 10 years ago as the leader of their
Mukhabarat. It's military intelligence. Mm-hmm.
And we have accounts from individuals who claim that he personally tortured them. And we know he was the guy that America outsourced torture to with renditions to Egypt starting in the 90s during the Clinton administration and heavily escalated under Bush. And so how can we reconcile the reality of who this man is with any connection to the aspirations of the Egyptian people?
Well, Omar Suleiman, this former head of Egyptian military intelligence, stands for most of the policies against which the protesters are protesting. So, you know, his appointment as vice president by President Hosni Mubarak in the wake of the huge protests that began on January 25th, was not a concession. It was a threat. It was a threat that Omar Suleiman would do to you what he's already done to others if you don't settle down. And so it was a polarizing move. And I don't think, I mean, we'll have to see. If the protest movement has any legs, if it's able to continue to organize and continue to protest, if the military doesn't succeed in behind the scenes arresting people and getting rid of them, then I think that particular move will be seen as having been extremely unwise. But the Obama administration, you asked, do they embrace Omar Suleiman? I mean, can you say French kiss?
Well, and I was trying to come up with a comparable, and it would have been as if Saddam Hussein said, okay, I'm going to leave, and my son Uday is going to take over, and the people will love him.
Yes, or if he had appointed the head of Iraqi Mukhabarat as his vice president and said, well, okay, maybe I'll leave the thing to him. I mean, is that really going to satisfy people? No. And, you know, we don't talk so much about this, but some of the discontents in Egypt are over the Egyptian complicity with Israeli policies towards the Palestinians of blockading the civilian population of Gaza, which is illegal in international law. Dov Weisglass, an advisor to Ariel Sharon, said he's going to put the Palestinians on a diet. And, you know, this is a very sinister thing to say, because what you're saying is you're going to deny, you're going to put children in a position of food insecurity. You're not going to necessarily starve them, but they'll be on the edge. And this is also comes out from the WikiLeaks cables, that this was the policy. And in the West Bank, they're actively just stealing Palestinian land.
Professor, I know your time is limited, so let me ask you three more questions. One, do you see the potential for the changes in Egypt to lead to a kind of change in equilibrium, what I would call the balance of terror in the Middle East, so that Israel will be forced to reevaluate its posture toward the Palestinians?
I think Israeli political parties now have a configuration, and the Israeli government now has a configuration, so that it's impossible for them to reconfigure things because of domestic issues. The Netanyahu government would fall if it began being more law-abiding and more conciliatory to Palestinian aspirations. So I don't expect the changes in Egypt to produce a change in Israeli policy. However, I do think that the change in Egypt is likely to raise the cost over the medium term of Israeli policy. I think the Egyptians could well cease cooperating with the Israeli blockade on Gaza, which would be a big blow to Israeli policy. I think the Egyptians may well be more vocal and active in complaining about the colonization of the West Bank and East Jerusalem. So I think Israeli policy won't change as a result. However, the cost of it will. And this makes for a very volatile and possibly dangerous situation.
Professor, sometime in the past year, you and I talked about Iraq, and I expressed skepticism that we would actually have American troops out by the end of this year, 2011. And they're now starting to float some excuses as to why we need to keep at least a significant remainder force there. What's your sense of how this is going to play out this year?
I believe that Barack Obama is committed to getting the troops out of Iraq. What Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki says is that the Status of Forces Agreement, which was signed by the Iraqi Parliament and the Bush administration, cannot be changed. You could have a subsequent treaty if Parliament was willing to make one. But remember who's in this Parliament. It's got a big representation from the Muqtada Sadr group. It's got representation from Sunni Arabs who don't want U.S. Troops on their soil. So the likelihood that you could get a new agreement through Parliament is low. Al-Maliki says he doesn't want one. He doesn't want U.S. bases in Iraq. So I'm not sure what the counterindications are. Now, you're referring to reports that are floated out of the Pentagon or out of contractors to the Pentagon from time to time saying, well, there may be a need. But that's a form of lobbying. These people are terrified to see their meal ticket go away, and so they're trying to convince Congress, and especially the new Republican Congress, to put the brakes on this withdrawal. Congress really doesn't have a lot to say. This is an executive issue, and it's foreign policy, and then the Iraqis have a say. So
Democrats won't challenge a Democratic president. We've seen that.
Yeah. No, well, and the Democrats won out. I mean, they got elected. The ones that are still there got elected in 2006 mostly and 8 on the grounds of getting out of Iraq. So there may be a few U.S. troops left in Iraq after December 31st of this year. There may be some trainers. There may be some Air Force support guys. But there's not going to be infantry battalions, at least as things now seem.
And finally, when Joe Biden was in Kabul a few weeks ago, he assured our puppet leader there, Karzai, that we'll be there pretty much as long as he wants, but at least until 2014. A week later, in the State of the Union message, I believe the president dissembled or misled the American people by a carefully crafted statement that we're going to start bringing troops home this July. Where do you think the truth lies?
Well, the president isn't dissembling when he says this. What's going to happen is that there are 34 provinces in Afghanistan, and there are U.S. troops and NATO troops all over the country. So what they're going to do is take some provinces that seem fairly unproblematic with regard to security and start bringing the foreign troops out. And then once they bring them out of 2 provinces, then they'll bring them out of 4, and by 2014 there won't be very many foreign troops in Afghanistan. And this will certainly happen. First of all, the Europeans have almost all announced that they're getting out on this kind of timetable. Then the patience of the American public is not going to last forever with this war, which is already the longest war in our history, which is very expensive at a time when we don't have much money. So I think the president is mollifying the Democrats and his own constituency by saying, well, yes, we wanted to do this surge. We wanted to put Afghanistan on a solid footing before we left, but now we are going to start leaving. And I think that's right. I think that's what he's going to do.
Well, Professor Juan Cole, great to see you. Thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome, Peter. It's great seeing you.
The story is true. Dragnet.
Is every American living under a potential dragnet? A police state sweep that could grab your library records, inspect your credit card accounts. They already intercept your telephone calls and emails. Well, that is the question before us, and the so-called Patriot Act is once again up for renewal in the Congress of the United States. And there are some astounding developments. On the dark and troubling side, 3 members of the United States Senate have proposed making it permanent and ending the annual charade, from their point of view, of tipping a hand to civil liberties while reenacting one of the most oppressive statutes that has been on the books in my lifetime. And on the other hand, we are seeing that freshman members of Congress, particularly Republicans, and in particular a subset of those who link themselves to the Tea Party, are rejecting the cries of their own party leaders, and in a procedural vote on February 8th, 26 Republican members of the House voted against an extension of the Patriot Act. There were a total of 148 no votes, most of those obviously Democrats, and it was 7 short of the required 2/3 for that bill to move forward. Now, I think that Republican leaders in collusion with the White House will find a way around that, and likely the House will approve an extension. But it is very interesting that we are at least having a debate about these issues, and that there has been a rejection of the heavy-handed party leadership. To discuss this, I've invited Darrell Perry to return to the program. He is chair of the Boston Tea Party National Committee. He's the owner and managing editor of the Free Patriot Press, and I'll throw up links in the show file so that you can access his websites. Darrell, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be back, Peter.
And it is very interesting, the different coalitions that are being formed of people who recognize the threat to our Constitution and the rights it confers on each citizen posed by the Patriot Act, and it seems like we're coming out of a kind of post-9/11 slumber. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, and it's sort of a unlikely coalition of people, because you have Dennis Kucinich, who is arguably one of the more liberal congressmen,
mm-hmm.
although he's very, in my opinion, very good on the civil liberties issues. I don't necessarily agree with his economic point of views.
Understood.
But you have Dennis Kucinich teaming up, being a very loose term here,
yeah,
with people that, claim to be part of the Tea Party movement, voting against the Patriot Act.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a good thing, because you actually have congressmen once again using logic instead of just, my party says do this, so I'm going to do this.
And Daryl, I want to refresh our listeners, because some may not have heard your previous conversation with me. It occurred last year here on the Peter B. Collins podcast. But you are separate from the Sal Russo Tea Party Express. You are separate from Michelle Bachmann's incarnation of the Tea Party. And I'm sure if you responded to the State of the Union message, you'd actually look at the camera. But give our listeners just a thumbnail on the difference between these other groups that call themselves Tea Party and your Boston Tea Party.
Well, it should be noted that Michelle Bachmann actually voted in favor of extending the Patriot Act, which that's one, very obvious difference. But the Boston Tea Party was formed in 2006, which is three full years before all of these groups formed and started using the Tea Party name. The Boston Tea Party is an actual political party, not just a group of people using the name party and going out and saying how upset they are with the current spending levels, when the majority had absolutely no problem with the vast spending increases from 2001 to 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be noted that all of the Tea Party groups that are running around holding these large protests, they're all filing forms with a government requesting permission to hold a rally to say how upset they are with the government.
Yes. And you wouldn't...
That's just a bit of irony that most people don't get. Most people just don't catch that.
And you're saying that you wouldn't file for a permit. Is that what you're saying?
I have never filed for a permit for any rally that I have had.
Okay. All right. Well, and I believe you have a right to free association, and except in areas where you draw such a large crowd that permits are reasonable and required. I salute you for that. I don't think that we need permission to express our First Amendment rights to assemble and to speak freely. But I want to talk about the Patriot Act in particular, because when you and I spoke before, we have a lot of common ground and a lot of common criticism of first Bush and now Obama for the extension of presidential power, the abrogation of the balance of power between the three branches of government, the checks and balances, and the creeping police state that we see evidenced by the Patriot Act, by the continuing wiretapping and intercept of email communication in direct violation of the Fourth Amendment. And Obama continues to block any litigation to reassert our constitutional rights or to properly define them in the current context, by using the amnesty that was granted to the phone companies to take them out of any litigation. That was back in 2008 with the so-called FISA Reform Act. And also by extending claims of the state secret privilege, so that you cannot bring a lawsuit because, with one glaring exception, no group has been able to prove that they were actually wiretapped And therefore, we have this kind of Kafkaesque game that goes on regarding our constitutional rights. The Patriot Act is out in the light of day, but a year ago, it was renewed, I believe, by voice votes, so that there was no real record, there was no debate, and this occurred while most Americans were distracted by the excessive drama over the health insurance reform process, which was in its final weeks as the Patriot Act was renewed. Do you basically agree with that summation?
Yes, and not only was the Patriot Act renewed last year on voice vote, but it was added as an amendment to a jobs bill. So that made it even more so to where there would be little opposition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The way they tried to do it a couple days ago, instead of just the regular procedural, let's pass this with 50% plus one vote, they decided that they were going to suspend the rules that require debate and that require, you know, the ability to add amendments.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to suspend the rules, try and pass this with two-thirds majority. That way we don't have to debate this thing, and we can sort of, you know, sneak it in. They didn't get the two-thirds. So now they're just going to go along with the House rules and let it go up for regular vote with, you know, the 218 congressmen need to pass.
Right,
and they have those votes. One thing that I find odd is with one of the new House rules that was introduced by Speaker Boehner is every piece of legislation supposedly has to say what section of the Constitution gives them authority to do whatever they're proposing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Are they exempting the Patriot Act renewal from that House rule? And if not, what part of the Constitution gives them the authority to suspend the majority of the Bill of Rights?
Well, and that's what's crucial, and I appreciate that in the press briefing that you emailed to me and many others, that you enumerated the elements of the Patriot Act, because most people have just a very fuzzy sense of it, and I understand it. It was cobbled together and jammed through, and most members of Congress didn't even read it, including virtually all those who voted for it. But it amended 11 existing acts of Congress: the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, that's FISA, Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, the Money Laundering Control Act, the Bank Secrecy Act, the Right to Financial Privacy Act, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the Immigration and Nationality Act, the Victims of Crime Act of 1984, the Telemarketing and Consumer Fraud and Abuse Prevention Act, and you say by default portions of the Bill of Rights, and I agree with you. But when you see it spelled out, for example, the Financial Privacy Act, we know that the FBI can now use national security letters, which do not necessarily require review by a judge. They can be authorized by an FBI official, or even an individual FBI agent can just write one up. They can go to your bank, and they can demand to look at the records of your checking account, to see how you spent your money. And, of course, they claim they're looking to see if you contributed to some terrorist front group. But we know that these efforts are widely abused. The Justice Department's own Inspector General, Glenn Fine, has reported year after year since the Patriot Act went into effect that the national security letters are widely abused and that there is no real check. There's no appeal. Often the subject of the national security letter doesn't even know that he or she has had her files or his files examined by a federal agent.
It's also interesting that anyone that does actually receive notification that they are being investigated under the Patriot Act, they cannot tell anyone that they are being investigated under the Patriot Act without being charged with a felony for violating a section of the Patriot Act, which means if you or I or anyone else finds out that we are being investigated under the Patriot Act, and we call our lawyer and tell our lawyer, hey, I think I'm being investigated under the Patriot Act, help me fight this thing. You then committed a felony by telling your lawyer and having him try to help you.
Mm-hmm. And Daryl, and for the benefit of our listeners, in the immediately following podcast, I'm scheduled to interview Susan Lindauer. Lindauer has published a book called Extreme Prejudice, and in it she details the bizarre story of what happened to her under the Patriot Act. She was working as an intelligence asset for the United States, and she claims that she warned the Bush administration, including her second cousin, Bush's chief of staff, Andrew Card, about the impending attacks of 9/11, and that she did so in August of 2001. And when she attempted to share that pre-invasion of Iraq intelligence with members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, she was arrested. She was detained under secret charges that she was never permitted to review. She could not face her accusers. And she went into a bizarre parallel universe where she was ordered by a court in New York, presided over by Judge Mukasey, who then became the replacement for Alberto Gonzalez as Attorney General. And Mukasey required her to go for a psychiatric evaluation, even though there was no evidence of any psychiatric problem. Essentially, the government just alleged that she might be suicidal, and therefore they wanted to detain her at an Air Force base, a military base in Texas. They said she would be there for 4 months, but she was held for 7 months. And ultimately, she was never charged. And when her lawyers finally got control of the case and confronted the government, the charges were dismissed just a week after Barack Obama was elected president in November of 2008. It's an amazing story. And Daryl, I don't expect that you're familiar with the details of Lindauer's case, but as you heard me describe it, have you heard anything more abusive, more contradictory to our constitutional rights than what I just summarized?
You know, what you just summarized sounds, if a few of the names of agencies were changed, sounds like it could be any kind of story that came out of Nazi Germany, Soviet Russia, or Communist China. But we're told that we live in a quote-unquote free country, but yet you have people being charged and detained basically for indefinite lengths of time without even knowing what they're being accused of having done or possibly just thought that they were going to do.
Well, and
it's very scary.
We have seen this as well. I referred indirectly to the case against wiretapping that was brought in San Francisco federal court on behalf of the now-defunct Al Haramain charity. And if people want to Google, or actually if you go to my website and enter in the search window, John Eisenberg. Eisenberg is the attorney for this group. And they were actually able to prove that they were wiretapped, Daryl. And despite that, there was one stage of the process where Eisenberg was asked to write rebuttal arguments to government arguments that he wasn't permitted to see. So he had to go fishing in the dark. If the government says that Al Haramain was not wiretapped, then we say this. But he had no idea of what the government allegations or briefs or arguments were, yet he was permitted to construct universal responses to the kinds of things that he could guess about. But he was never, even after the case was decided in his favor, he was never allowed to see the government's charges or arguments in the case.
That is un-American.
Well, it certainly is. So let's talk a little bit about the action on Capitol Hill, because with this stunning vote, it was a real reversal for the Republican leadership. As you suggested, it appears that they will find a way to bring the bill forward for an up or down vote requiring a simple majority. And based on the test vote on February 8th, they clearly have the 218 votes they need to jam this through. But we have started a debate, and Daryl, I'll tell you that I've been lobbying members of Congress when I talk to them about other things. And on the night of the State of the Union address, I got a liberal Democrat and a very conservative Republican both to agree to vote against extending the Patriot Act. The Democrat is John Garamendi of California. The Republican is Tom McClintock of California. And McClintock has Tea Party leanings and is quite a libertarian. And he indirectly apologized for voting in favor of extending the Patriot Act last year because he was a newbie in Congress and he said he was just getting up to speed. But he said this year he's up to speed and he was not willing to vote in favor of extension. So I think it is interesting that we're seeing members of both parties. It seems a little bit of a stretch to call it bipartisan because it seems to be that they're voting their own constitutional values, and that seems to transcend party.
As it should. You know, whether or not something is constitutional should not depend on whether one claims to be a Republican, one claims to be a Democrat, libertarian, green, progressive, whatever. The Constitution says what the Constitution says, and that doesn't change based on political affiliation. How one interprets what is meant by what it says does change. You have some people that say, oh, well, no, the Necessary and Proper Clause says Congress can do anything, and then, you know, just find some weird, tricky, roundabout way to loop it back into one of the 19 powers that's listed in Article 1, Section 8.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the way Eisenhower pushed through the highway system, is he convinced everybody that it was necessary for national defense. Oh, well, if we don't build a highway system, then we can't get military trucks and personnel from base to base. Well, if you read the words of James Madison, who wrote the Constitution, and he was explaining, he said, no, Congress doesn't have the authority to build roads. They can't say that it's part of regulating interstate commerce. If they could, you know, do anything they wanted to, then there would be no need to specify and enumerate certain powers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a total bastardization of the Constitution to where Congress thinks that they can do whatever they want to, and then they'll, you know, ex post facto find a way to say that it fits in with one of the authorities that they have.
And, Daryl, I have been in collusion with a group, a nonprofit called the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. They're based in Washington, and I don't know if you're familiar with them. But they have been leading a charge. They had a lobbying day on Capitol Hill about 2 weeks ago to contact members and try to educate them about various concerns about the Patriot Act. And they are promoting the reintroduction of the Justice Act, which would in part reauthorize the non-controversial elements of the Patriot Act, while, according to them, imposing meaningful protections for civil liberties. And I don't have details of the Justice Act in front of me. It was introduced in the previous Congress, but not passed. And I'm curious if you know any of the details of the Justice Act.
I do not know any details of the Justice Act. I am somewhat familiar with the Bill of Rights Defense Council,
mm-hmm.
but I am not aware of the Justice Act.
All right.
It would be interesting if I could actually get a hold of text of what they're proposing, and you say it would eliminate the non-controversial aspect.
No, it would renew the non-controversial while amending the parts that we're concerned about. So I believe it was introduced by Senator Feingold, and so it's an orphan now since he was not reelected last fall.
Yeah, that would definitely be something interesting to look at. If anybody knows where I can find text of that, please, you know, leave a comment and I'm sure Peter can get the info to me, because I would love to actually read the Justice Act and see what it is actually proposing.
Well, I'll follow up on it. It appears there's a link to it at the bordc.org website. So I'll research that and include it with the show information at peterbcollins.com. Well, Darryl,
if it were up to me, the entire Patriot Act would be repealed, because apparently the quote-unquote non-controversial aspects are not really authorizing any new powers to any branch of the government or any alphabet group, FBI, CIA, whoever.
Right.
So, if the non-controversial things don't actually give any new powers, then why even have a bill authorizing anything? Just allow the different groups to talk together. And actually, before September 11th, they were allowed to talk to each other. People think, the FBI and the CIA were not allowed to converse. They were, but they don't like each other, so they don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, Darryl, I will follow up on this and post the information, as I said, on the website. It's great to talk with you again. Is there anything you'd like to add in closing here about your concerns, or maybe to motivate our listeners to contact members of the House and Senate, because it's, at this point, not yet too late to weigh in on the proposed extension of the Patriot Act?
You're right. It's not too late. And if you remember, the last line of the article that I sent you and that I posted online says, we must ensure that this unjust act of Congress is killed. And if it isn't, I say we take to the streets. And I'm serious when I say that.
I'm sorry. Americans don't do that, Darryl. We'll watch the Egyptians on television. But, Americans don't actually...
We need to do the same thing that they're doing.
Well, I actually agree with you. I think that we do need to stand up and be counted and not sit idly by, passively allowing our civil liberties and our constitutional rights to be taken away from us. Darryl Perry, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Peter.
Good to talk to you again. Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show, protected by what remains of our constitutional rights.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until